Listening faithful, welcome back to another episode of the Keystone Chronicles podcast. Guys, this week we have Joel Chilcote on. Joel is a local guy to me, and me and him have been trying to get together and chop it up here for a while. And it's a pretty exciting conversation, more of a sportsman spotlight type episode, just kind of Joel talking about his obsession with the outdoors, whether that be with the fly rod or whether that be maybe with some black powder. And he's just one of those guys that is just super passionate about talking about it. And I think as you listen to this episode, you'll have a lot of agreeing with some of the things that we cover and go over. Kind of one of those you're listening and kind of shaking your head up and down episodes, just in agreement with a lot of the stuff that we cover, whether that be from cleaning up sulfur creeks in the state of Pennsylvania, or moving along to some of the ways that we were raised in the outdoors and some of the experiences that we seen growing up, and also paying homage to those that that shed the light and paved the way for us in our hunting and fishing worlds that we have here today. Super fun to have you on, Joel. Thank you so much for coming through, guys. Thanks, everybody, for reaching out. Once again, don't forget to comment, rate, and subscribe on all these episodes that you're listening to. If you think that there's somebody that you guys would like to hear or see on the show, please don't be afraid to reach out to me, and I think you'll enjoy this episode. God bless. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Keystone Chronicles podcast. This one has been a long time coming, Joel, and I'm glad that you came out and we got to sit down in person. This is the way to do it. No knock on everything that I do remotely, but even the remote guys will tell you, man, I really wish I was sitting there with you, because it is the best. But unfortunately, you know, with modern day and especially travel and, geez, gasoline, you can't even afford to drive down the road. You know, this is not something that we can always do. But since you're close to me, this is going to be good. And a lot of guys are going to really appreciate this conversation, I'm sure. So, ladies and gentlemen, hailing from not too far from me, Mr. Joel Chilcote. How are you, brother?
Good. How are you doing?
Good, man. It's good to have you here. And like I said, I'm excited for our conversation. And before we get started, man, just sell yourself to us real quick, who you are, where you're from, whatever you want to tell us about yourself.
Yes. Yeah, my name is Joel Chilcote. I am from born and raised in Hollandtown, not too far here from Marcus. And like I said, I've been there all my life. And I've always been a big part of the outdoors, and that's kind of why we're here today, to talk about that stuff.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, man, me and you both get, you know, just get our kicks off on it, and that's why these conversations are so good. But, you know, when you were growing up, man, you're a Pennsylvania heritage boy, and that's what this show is about. So just fill me in on what it was like for you growing up. You know, is there anybody you want to kind of pay homage to or anything like that that raised you in the outdoors or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, both sides of my family, my mother and father, both of their fathers were really big into the outdoors, along with my dad too. And a lot of my family, both sides, have always been into the outdoors. And I probably started going hunting with my dad probably when I was about 4 years old. And I remember up behind my parents' place, going up there, and he would take me up there in the wooden ladder stand, and for the longest time, it was just one little tiny wooden tree stand. Yeah. So he had like a built-in seat on it, and I would end up sitting in between his legs, and 90% of the time, I'd end up falling asleep, or he'd be like, hey, quit moving around. Yeah. He's like, it's, you know, everything's going to see us here.
Yeah.
But
probably 12 foot high.
Yeah, wasn't very high off the ground at all. Yeah, no, man. Not at all.
Hey, yeah, man, that's same. I mean, same upbringing for me, you know. Same exact scenario. I can remember, though, you know, and we're not too many years apart, so you may even remember, but, man, I can remember, I'd be like, Dad, look, you know, here comes some does or whatever. Well, geez, I would have been probably, like you said, super young. I don't know, 4 to 7 spectrum, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And just, like, herds of, like, 30 doe.
Mm-hmm.
But there would have been, like, 1 4-point. Or one spike.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a 6-point was like, oh, you know, a 6-point. Mm-hmm. Right. And I remember telling my dad, like, oh, look, here come the doe or whatever. And that wasn't ever, they actually had a 3-day doe season, is what it was.
Yeah.
So it was open season for 1 week for buck, for antlered.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was the
three-day dose season. I think, if I remember right, and I could be wrong, but I think it was the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I think is how they did it.
Yeah, I think so.
But it's come a long way, man. It's wild. And, like, we do bring this up often on the show, but, like, the antler restrictions just totally transformed.
Yeah.
That, and we did, a lot of guys don't want to hear, but we did start whacking a lot more does, and that changed some things. You know, yeah. Our doe-to-buck ratio changed. But, honestly, gone are the days of seeing all those deer, which did make it exciting when you were young.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so that's like a double-edged sword, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's for the better, at least if you ask me.
Yeah.
There are still areas where there's lots of deer. You know, even like there's spots like that aren't too far from here that I can remember. I'll tell a story real quick, and then we'll get right back to you growing up in the outdoors. But they opened the water tower in Glendale.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we used to go there when we were kids and feed like the deer out of our
house. Oh, yeah.
Right?
Same here.
Right?
Yeah.
Like bread and such, you know?
Yeah.
And then there was so many deer. It was crazy in there, man. And then they opened the water tower it was only for flintlock.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
And oh my, it was insane, man. It was crazy. Like there was deer running. I remember I had a flintlock. My dad had a flintlock. And like he was just loading the guns as I was just just firing at these deer, and they were running all over the place. And I actually I killed my first deer with a flintlock there.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first one I ever killed with a flintlock. It was a doe. Never forget it.
Yeah.
Never forget it. Then that did hook me on black powder, did. But
yeah.
But back to what you were saying, you know, you were raised in the outdoors. You remember being in a tree stand. You remember being with your dad, and like, you're probably cold.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably like, this kind of sucks. But something happened, right? Something happened in your head or within you where you're like, no, I actually like this. This mm-hmm. is awesome.
Yeah.
Right? And just tell me a little bit more about, you know, some more of your upbringing in it.
Yeah. Like I said, I was probably, like I said, probably 4 or 5 years old when I started going with my dad deer hunting. And like I said, that would be, you know, obviously starting in the fall time when hunting season came around. And I guess as I got older and stuff, and as the more I went with them, you know, we would see, you know, more deer, you know, we'd see turkeys, mm-hmm. and, you know, then we started, you know, he started taking me small game hunting, like for squirrels. And then, you know, some friends of his had beagles at one time. So he took me like rabbit hunting, mm-hmm. you know, chasing rabbits.
The best.
With dogs. And then, I would say like the first time when we was in that tree stand. Now, as years went on, we made the tree stand bigger so we could both sit on the bench seat, and you know, I wouldn't be sitting in between his legs. And
you got four sets of eyes too.
Exactly. And I remember the first time I was ever with him, he'd shot a doe with the bow. And I kind of think from that point on, like it was like, mm-hmm. wow, that was pretty cool to see it done with a bow.
Yeah, right.
And then, like I said, but he had taken me rifle hunting and stuff too. And then, like I said, just over time, I knew it was like, okay, I think it's going to definitely be in my blood here where definitely it's going to be fishing and hunting.
Yeah,
and,
right.
you know, I can't see myself doing anything different at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. I agree with you. Whatever. I don't know what happens within you. Like, I don't know if it's like this primal thing, like that it's ancestral. I don't know. I don't know what happens. But once you, I try to explain to people, I'm like, once you have that connection and then also get that adrenaline.
Oh, yeah.
It's, you can never go back.
No.
It's like nothing compares to this.
No.
And that's why, like, guys live their whole life to chase that.
Oh, yeah.
Every single year.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Or even, like, fishing, you know. Like, for me, for fishing, like, I just, it's peaceful.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and so is being in the woods and everything, but there's just something about the water that.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, happy days whenever you're on the water. You know what I
mm-hmm.
mean? Or, like, there are certain challenges. Like, you know, I can think of, like, man, I got a bow cast up under that mountain laurel. And I'm like, son of a, you know, I got to try to get up in there. And when you get that perfect cast, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, you're like, that's the one.
Yeah.
And then whack. You
yeah.
know? And you knew it. You knew it. And it's challenging, but it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
But that is kind of what I want to dive into here, man. You know, I know you have a heavy passion for fishing.
Yeah.
And, it's no secret. I talk on the show all the time. Pennsylvania is top trout state. You know, we will go toe-to-toe with you. There's probably only
I'd say there's probably only 8 to 9, I think, legitimate competitors with our state when it comes to trout fishing.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, there's lots of other fishing that we're not, you know, we don't have compared to some other states, but our trout fishing is second to none. And some would even argue that we don't even need the trout stock. Our trout stocking program is probably one of the best in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, many will argue there's plenty of places they stock that they're not very happy they're stocking. You know? So, yeah, man, take me down the road. How did you get into to fishing? What kind of fishing are you into? And just explain your passion for it to us.
Yeah, it kind of goes like when I started there about the whole hunting deal. I was very young age, probably 4, 5, 6 years old. I started going fishing with my dad. We would go anywhere from, you know, crappie fishing in the springtime, you know, going down to, say, the Big Juniata for smallmouth, bass and stuff. Like I said, I have some friends that had some camps down there, and, you know, he took me down there quite a few times. And then, of course, in the wintertime, we'd do some ice fishing, you know, for the ice. That was always, it's always nice to go when we get enough ice, because the last couple years, we just haven't quite got enough ice to go.
True.
But I would say probably, you know, my heart is probably definitely on fly fishing. And
for trout?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, like I said, I've done it for trout, bass, steelheads. Steelheads are a ball, especially when you're catching one a 10-foot four weight.
Right.
That is.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah, it is pretty wild. It definitely puts on a good fight, but it's it definitely puts on for a good time.
Hell
but
yeah.
But I remember I was in sixth grade, and we had to pick it was like a hobby day project, and we had to pick a particular hobby that we really had a lot of interest in. And kind of had to display like some information about your hobby, and like you could put, you know, you could do pictures, or, you know, however you want to present it. So I remember I wanted to do mine on fly fishing. And like I said, at that time, I probably would have been probably 11, 12, because that was just right before I got into high school. And I remember I did mine on fly fishing, and I remember I had kind of like what kind of got me into it, kind of like what we're talking here now. And I remember we had made I made like a display of certain flies on there, and like, you know, they explained like about a dry fly and then a wet fly and a nymph, and, you know, kind of went through the whole life cycle of a mayfly in a sense. And that was kind of like, it was actually neat doing a report about something that I really liked. And then just from there, I just kind of always stuck with it and been doing it for probably 20 some years now. But kind of like when I first started fly fishing, and I would say, you know, probably a lot of people were, I would say probably at the same step. I did mainly a lot of dry fly fishing, and I was like, it was always neat watching them come off the top, and, you know, and, you know, catching the dry flies, you know, as the mayflies are hatching and stuff. But I just knew, like, I would definitely really like to get into nymph fishing. And I was like, because you think about it, a lot of them trout, they're doing a lot of the feeding. They're on the bottom. You know, we're getting them flies as they're coming up to the top, you know, to, you know, hatch into a mayfly. So I remember one day, me and my dad, we were down at the Little Juniata. And I kept watching this guy just, boom, one after another. Just crazy. I'm like, what is he doing different? So then I just started paying attention. And I noticed that he was using, like, real long rod. Kind of looked like he was maybe using some different color, you know, fly line. And I was like, I want to talk to this guy. Because I was like, there's definitely something here that I would like to, you know, inquire more about. So then he had a Euro nymphing rig. And I was like, okay. I said, this is definitely something I'm going to start checking into. Of course, every time you go out there, you definitely learn something new. You know, whether it's, hey, this fly, you know, this color, this water condition worked great today. Or, you know, hey, I was catching them on a, you know, a size 4 streamer one day when the water's ripping and it's muddy, you know, because, you know, there's always different conditions out there, and the fish are always going to be eating something different. And then I really started getting into the Euro nymphing along with my dad. Like I said, my dad had probably been doing it now for probably at least 40 years or more at this point. And me and him really started getting into the whole Euro nymphing. And like I said, with a lot of great people that I've met over the years too through fly fishing, you know, and all the friends, you know, are out there that eventually hear this. You know, I appreciate all the information that you gave me over the years, and I met some really good people that way. And just from there, I just really got taken off on the whole Euro nymphing probably in the last, I would say, probably 10 years. And it was a night and day difference once I started figuring out the Euro game. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't change back at all.
I think there's a lot of guys that would agree with you.
Yeah.
I mean, especially tight line Euro nymphing is like probably top.
Yeah.
Especially like, I mean, I could think of certain situations where it's, you're going to catch probably the bigger trout too.
Yeah.
Right? Because they're just laying kind of like where it's deep and then it starts to get shallow again.
Yeah.
They'll kind of lay right at the edge of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's hard to explain unless you can show somebody kind of what you're looking at.
Yeah.
You know, or like, I know I definitely have like certain things that I like to fish more than others.
Yeah.
You know, if I can find a creek that's like very heavy and bendy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I love that undercut.
Yeah.
I love, like, if I see a creek that has, like, mountain laurel on it,
mm-hmm.
I just, there's just something about it. Like,
oh, yeah.
I love that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to fish in most of the time. But normally, you know, at least in my experience, like, you'll find a lot of mountain laurel where the water's colder, so you know there's probably trout. You know, it's mountain streams. You know, the mountain streams are mountain laurel streams for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
At least the ones that I'm fishing,
yeah,
you know, heavy and maybe like towards the bottoms and the pines, and then they turn into mountain laurels as you get, you know, up in elevation,
yeah,
you know. But I'm also hunting brook trout.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have no knock on catching big browns.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. You know, I love ripping into a 16, 18 inch wild brown or bigger. You know, sometimes rare, but it happens.
Yeah.
But it's just, the brook trout is doing it for me. I mean,
yeah.
They're awesome. Mm-hmm. They're incredible. They're incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, the colors, they do it for me. Now, I do know, like, some places in our area that I can show you, like, there are some wild rainbows and stuff like that, but they just don't do it for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I love them, like I said, but if we're going fishing, if me and you leave here right now, like, we're going blue line hunting and we're looking for, we want brook trout.
Yeah.
But.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about the cool things that you've seen fly fishing. Like, is it the environment for you? Like, is that what does it for you? Is it, the certain fish? Like I said, for me, I love the environment and I love to take it in. Mm-hmm. I love to look up in the sky and look around and just say, oh my God, this is so beautiful. This is awesome. This is so calming.
Yeah.
You know, or certain things, like you might see like a big burrow in a tree, mm-hmm. right? And the creek's going around it. And you're like, how did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how did that form like that?
Yeah.
You know, but for the most part, like, I see a heavy bend in the creek and I see an undercut and I'm like 40 yards away, 30 yards away. And I'm looking and I'm like, oh, that's the spot. You know, mm-hmm. I already got it picked out. Like, I'm just like, I'm pulling my gun up with my crosshairs and I'm locking in,
yeah.
You know, and like for me, like, that's the thrill. I also get the thrill from fishing new places.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know? Like, oh my God, that is so much fun.
Yeah.
Especially whenever you're tearing into them and you're just like, I can't believe I'm catching this many fish in here, or size or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But so what are some of the things, like, you're like, man, that's something that really does it for me there.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, like along with what you were saying, definitely the environment, because, you know, I think we could both probably agree here, but God paints a pretty good picture.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, it's just neat being on the stream and seeing, like, you know, you could be standing there and, you know, there might be some deer coming down there while you're, you know, getting crossing the creek, or even getting mm-hmm. a drink out of the creek, or, you know, I've been places where I've actually seen a bear swim below me in the creek.
Yeah.
And that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like I said, just seeing, you know, certain times of the year with certain mayflies hatching, like,
mm-hmm.
especially like a green drake hatch.
Right.
Like, I would say personally, just from my experience, I may not catch very many fish during that hatch, but I tell you what, it's just something neat to see.
Yeah.
Especially on Penn's Creek, because that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
To see.
I haven't made it down there for that. I have been in the area where there was probably and I should have. It's just I was out fishing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I should have went and tried to fish that. I just haven't yet. And I do plan on making that. You know, we live close enough that I need to make that a...
Yeah. Yeah, you know. It's definitely something to see. for sure. Yeah. It's that, and, you know, not only the green drakes were hatching at the time, you know, there's sulfurs, there's caddises, there's just, you know, all different kinds of bugs at that time of the year.
Yeah.
Really popping off. So it's just neat, you know, just to see that whole cycle that way.
Yeah. You know, some other things that really I feel like make me feel like I'm one with the stream, I guess, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But just sometimes I think it's just calming to watch, like, if you move through the stream and, like, you create a little bit of mud or something and you stop, like, just watching the mud.
Yeah.
Like, dissipate.
Yeah.
And that's, like, so stupid. But, like, I always, like, compare that to, like, life.
Yeah.
You know, like, you move around, you may get, like, a little dirty or, you know, things maybe get a little rough or whatever. But, you know, if you just wait it out, you know, everything clears up. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I try to tell everybody. I'm like, hey, listen. Especially, I know a lot of retired guys that are just don't, like, do nothing with their time. And I'm like, you guys are nuts, man. Mm-hmm. You, where you live and you are not hunting and fishing, like, you don't even need to be hunting and fishing. Like, you could literally just hike.
Mm-hmm.
We have, like, a stupid amount of game lands, a stupid amount of parks and recreation. And our parks are great. DCNR does a great job. Like, there's clean bathrooms in all these places and stuff. And I can remember growing up, like, some of them weren't so – they weren't so nice.
No.
Like, they were there. But I'm telling you, it's been a long time since I run across a park where it was, like, not, like – like, new structures, like, nice bathrooms, you know, like, running water.
Mm-hmm.
Running water on these places. Like, I can remember, you know, like, they just dig the hole or whatever.
Yeah.
And you got the freaking creaky sliding stall door that you open and close. But
you
go in there to take a crap, and your turd comes out, and it takes 15 seconds to plunge and hit the freaking ground. You know?
Yeah.
And now these places, they're running water, man.
Yeah.
You know, it's wild. It's crazy. So, you know, like, that money, whatever money is coming into there, like, I can promise you that a lot of it is going to these parks.
Yeah.
They got new pickup trucks. They got new equipment. You see new John Deere tractors cutting trails and stuff, and you're like, man, they really are spending some money in some of these places.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, at least that's my experience. You know, if you guys disagree, shoot me a message, and we'll contact whoever's supposed to be running the park that you're saying it's run down.
But, yeah.
But, yeah, man, you said that you tie your own flies.
Yes.
And, you know, I feel like that's, like, the progression of a fly fisherman.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, hey, this isn't enough for me to get these off my buddy anymore or to buy these anymore, right? Like, I have to do this on my own. Like, I must take this feather and make a fish bite it.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So just fill me in on some of your experiences of tying your own flies and what's that like whenever you tear into a trout or a bass or anything, whatever you're fishing when you have your own.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like I said, I've been tying flies probably for, like I said, probably over 20 years now at least. And, like I said, I remember, like I said, my dad was probably one of the biggest ones. Like I said, it really got me into fly fishing. But, like I said, I would watch him tie flies, and then, you know, he would explain to me, like, you know, it's pretty neat how you can take, you know, a mayfly that's, you know, flying out in the, you know, in the air there by the creek, you know, where how it's living under the rocks for the longest time, you know, and tie something to imitate that. And I was like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then I just started, you know, I might have started off tying, like, little woolly boogers, you know, just to kind of get the hang of it. And then, you know, I get a little bit better with that. And then, you know, I'm going to try to tie some caddises. And then, you know, I'm going to try to tie some sulfurs. And then once I really started getting into the Euro nymphing, I started tying, like, a lot of different, like, Euro nymphs and just quick, simple patterns. And then, of course, I would always be, you know, and I still do it today. Like, I still, you know, what can I change if this fly, you know, that maybe in, you know, this crick, this bug's a little bit darker, you know, could be the same bug in a different crick, and it might be just a little bit different color.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
So, yeah, like I said, I've seen where sulfurs are one, you know, bright orange in one color, and go to the other crick, and they're like a pale yellow.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess what I'm trying to say, I usually try to make sure I have whole color spectrums covered.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, whether it's from a, you know, a light color to medium color, you know, to a real dark color. And, but it is a great feeling when you can tie those flies of your own and then go out and, you know, catch fish on them. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah. Makes you feel way more self-sufficient.
Yeah.
And it's, that's a pride thing, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because
Is it not wild? Like, these fish, you think, like, they're these dumb things.
Yeah.
But, like, they can see.
Oh, yeah.
They can see very, very, very well.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And I think, you know, fly fishermen, they have the respect for that because they do understand, like, how sensitive they are. And,
oh,
like,
yeah.
People don't know, like, how sensitive they are to, like, vibrations on the ground.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you break a limb up here, that doesn't mean that fish didn't feel that reverberation in the water.
Yeah.
You know? But, you know, usually shadows and stuff to get them, but they always impress me.
Like, mm-hmm.
Oh, you know, yeah. Like you said, you can be, so if you have that orange, fly mm-hmm. and, you try to run that in that other creek where they're kind of yellow,
mm-hmm.
good luck.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like if a sulfur's orange here and it's not yellow here and you use your orange one, but then you put your yellow one in and bang.
Yeah.
And you're like, these are like half a shade of color off.
Yeah.
But that's all it takes,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, and even, like, I've seen, like, with different colors of beads, because I use a lot of tungsten. I mean, that's pretty mm-hmm. much primarily what I use with tying all my, like, Euro nymphs. And, you know, I might tie a waltz worm that has a copper bead, you know, and it might be working good, you know, in that creek, and I go take it to that creek and say I use a waltz worm that has, like, a black bead, mm-hmm. and that could be just all the difference that it needs.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I said, it's really neat to go out and tie your own stuff and go out and catch something on it. It's definitely cool.
Yeah, I agree with you, man. So what kind of setup do you run then? Like, what do you have? What do you prefer to use? Fly rod, like backing? What's your seem to be your go-to thing?
Yeah, so my Euronymph rig that I like to use now, I have a 10-foot four-weight syndicate. I've had them for many a years, and I've had multiple syndicates, but I would say probably the 10-foot four-weight. It's just kind of a good all-around rod, you know, for trout. Like I said, I have caught steelheads on a 10-foot four-weight, which that's a ball. And like I said, I have caught bass on them too, and it just seems like it's still got enough sensitivity to where you could really feel good, you mm-hmm. know, when you're trout fishing, tight lining and stuff, to enough to where it'll still handle a bass or a steelhead. But like I said, I use, and then I have for a reel, I have a Cheeky Boost reel. I really like the Cheeky reels. Like I said, I think the one that I have now is the Limitless 375 is what I use. Mm. And then I like to use the Trout Legend nymph line is what I have now, which I think they actually discontinued it, which kind of made me upset because I really like their lines. So I'll probably eventually maybe switch to like a Cortland or something like that among those lines. But and like I said, I use, I tie all my own leaders too. And like I said, that's pretty much my whole setup there. Yeah.
Yeah. If you were to tell a guy or woman that was just getting into fly fishing,
mm-hmm.
where would you tell them to start? How would you tell them to start? What to look for, I guess, kind of guiding them into starting to fly fish in some way?
Yeah, very good question. So if I was to go about that, probably what I would do as far as, you know, I would probably just, you know, just starting out, just kind of get the concept, you know, how the whole fly cycle works. Mm-hmm. Just so that way they kind of know what they're, you know, what they're getting into at that sense. And then, you know, from there, I would probably start like with just, you know, basic casting with a rod, with a fly rod. Maybe start off dry fly fishing because, you know, everybody loves seeing them come off the top and taking flies. You know, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, especially when they're 10 feet in front of you, you know,
because
it's just like you're almost like a video game. Like you see the fish and here comes a fly and you're just waiting for the two to meet, you know, mm-hmm. to yank.
Especially if you're sight fishing.
Oh yeah. That's sometimes it's like, it's almost like a tease in a sense.
Yeah,
like
right.
you want to pull it, but it's like too soon.
You gotta wait. Or they spit it out right in front of you.
Yep. I've seen that too. And, like I said, just kind of get, like I said, basic understanding of flies, you know, how the whole cycle works, and then kind of just get into casting, and then, you know, take maybe to a stock stream, you know, once, you know, season would come in or, you know, mm-hmm. that time of the year, and just kind of keep going at it. And, And like I said, over time, you know, as that, you know, guy or woman would get better into fishing, you know, could take it a step further where, you know, would maybe want to try to swing wet flies or, you know, get into the, you know, the Euro nymphing or just, you know, nymphing in general. Because like I said, there's many very, you know, variations of nymphing out there that you can do. And, but yeah, like I said, I would definitely recommend it to anybody, you know, because
it's a rabbit hole, man.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure you catch that first one, you'll be hooked.
Yeah.
You know, right. Especially on something you tied to your own. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. I like to talk to a lot of people about trying to get into stuff like that, or even if they don't like that and they're intimidated by it, they just want to stick to a spinning in some sort. I tell them, well, make your own lures.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, live bait. Yeah, sure. Live bait's great. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to beat like a minnow.
Yeah.
I grew up using minnows, and like, even with me using any other thing, I as far as trout fishing, I don't know that you can really, really beat it. I mean, maybe during a hatch, you know, but, I tell them, you know, well, you should try to make your own lure. Just try.
Yeah.
Try to do this, try to do that. Because, you know, you're going to take way more pride in it.
Yeah.
You know, and then that usually would probably lead into them, well, I want more, right? I need more of a challenge.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, they're picking up a fly rod.
Mm-hmm.
And then I need more of a challenge. I want to tie my own flies.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a rabbit hole. But, you know, here in Pennsylvania, I feel like we have some of the best waterways, and I am not quiet about that. I like to voice my opinion on it. Is there... Here in Pennsylvania, is there anything that I guess you look at from the Fish Commission standpoint and think, man, I think in your opinion, they could do this or do that, or that they do really well for the Fish Commission?
Yeah, very good point. I would say, like I said, just from... You know, some streams that I knew like years ago that were in very bad shape, you know, due to sulfur and things like that.
Yeah.
It's crazy now to look at that stream now and look like, wow, you know, that 20 years ago, I never would have thought, you know, there would be, you know, stock trout in that stream or, you know, any other, you know, a few other, you know, streams that I fished in the last few years where it's like, it's amazing, like, how long it's came. Since then. So, I mean, I would say, you know, between the Fish Commission, you know, and, you know, Trout Unlimited and a lot of those organizations that's kind of, you know, went together and things, I think they've done a pretty good job as far as on cleaning up some of these old mine acid drainage creeks, you know, going into beautiful trout streams. And it's, I think a lot of those streams too will have potential down the road as long as they keep with things. So, as far as that goes, I mean, I feel that they're doing pretty good that way.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. I can think of multiple that I know of.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, yeah, sediment ponds and limestone slurries and, you know, a whole bunch of stuff that they do differently that seems to work well.
Yeah.
You know, it takes time.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a long time. But, yeah, there's multiple that I can think of that have been cleaned up. And, man, I'm telling you, like, there's other ones that I wish, like, they'd really clean up because – oh, my goodness. The water is just the bends and the way that the creek moves, like, and the undercuts and the eddies and the, oh, my God, you're talking to, like, some of the best trout fishing waters I think that you could get around, but you can't because they're full of pollution. And I think at some point, you know, they may get cleaned up, but they won't unless you – bring it up all the time, you know, so that's why that's something I usually bring up and talk about. But is there anything else that you want to add that maybe, so since they are doing that well, do you think there's anything that they could take a step back, look at it, be like, maybe we should double down on this or take a look at that?
Maybe like if anything that I could think of in particularly, like if they go into a stream, you know, and, you know, they could be stalking it now and realize, you know, that there's, you know, a great potential like wild brown trout or brook trout population in there. And, you know, if it's there already, you know, why disturb it with stocked fish, you know, with wild fish?
Yeah.
You know, and I would think probably, you know, for me, just from my point of view here, I would say if there's wild fish in there, you know, leave them alone and, you know, let the wild ones raise themselves and, you know, don't let the stocked fish interfere.
Don't stalk over a wild population.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is, yeah, as you know, that is one of the top. You can get on any Pennsylvania forum.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And that's what you're going to.
Yeah.
You know, I know Little J right now. Anybody that listens to this that's local will probably know this. But there is a creek that runs into a prominent creek that is, let's just say it's near Blandberg. Okay. Mm-hmm. And they are going to hydro shock it. And any wild browns that are in there are getting taken out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they're going to do with them, and it ain't none of my business. But
right.
I know that so they basically have a barrier, and if there's any above that barrier that are in with the brook trout population, they're gone. Mm-hmm. They will no longer be in there. So they'll put the brook trout back, and they'll take the wild browns out. Now, over time, I'm sure maybe, you know, the wild browns will find a way back into there.
Yeah.
But basically what they're pleading to is, like, if you catch wild browns, do not stick them into these brook trout streams.
Yeah.
Right? And for those of the people that listen and don't know, like, they'll just – the brook trout will have, like, you know, a nice breeding ground, if you will, for simpler terms, and the brown trout will come in and just – they'll take them. They'll go right into the reds. They'll take them.
Yeah.
They'll just – and the brook trout, they don't have nowhere to go. So, yeah, the brown trout, you know, they're a little bit more pushy and edgy, and they get bigger. They eat more.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, they can live in a lot more other waters compared to a brook trout. They're super finicky. They need a certain temperature constantly. They, you know what I mean? They command a certain thing. The brown trout, they can live up to, like, 70-degree water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, brook trout wouldn't. They would die. They can't handle that. I mean, geez, I don't know if you catch brook trout, if they're stock brook trout, and you catch brook trout, and you decide to keep them, and you're going to eat them or something. Well, you got to eat them, like, now, because they just turn into, like, a mush.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's because they're fed freaking dog food or what goes on, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I will say, I have, you know, when I was younger, I have had people or been around people that have caught, like, a native trout, and I have eaten them, and they are different. They are most definitely different.
Yeah.
The colors and the inside, or even like a holdover.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a holdover trout. Sometimes you get holdover trouts and you'll open them up and you're eating them like a stocked holdover.
Yeah.
And they're pink. They turn mm-hmm. they start to turn like a pink color on the inside.
Yeah.
But I have heard, like, that is certain hatcheries and stuff, like what they feed and what their diets are. But yeah, the stalking over a wild population is not — it's probably not a good idea, but I'm not a fish biologist.
Yeah, same here. Yep.
But I haven't seen it do any good, though. So,
mm-hmm.
on the flip side, I fish areas where they stock upper, I fish lower, and I still catch lots of wild.
Yeah.
So, yep. I don't know what that impact is. I don't know how far these fish will actually travel. I know that I have caught stock trout in upper limits of stock trout streams that are miles. I mean,
mm-hmm.
miles. I'm talking like several, 6 to 7 miles. Like, you're not catching wild golden rainbow trout.
Yeah.
Well, I have. And you're talking miles. More than one. It's not like this random occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, they'll move.
Yep.
And I just like to know, like, how far they will. I guess they will move very, very far.
But, yeah.
But, yeah, they do that often around here. There is a couple I know, streams you know of too.
Yeah.
That they overstock on the wild population. And the wild population is really good. Like, mm-hmm. really, really good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know why they do it. You know, my assumption is the people that live in this area have connections to those people that stalk, and they want the fish stalked, and that's fine.
Yeah.
They like to stalk trout, and they want to fish the stalk trout. That's fine. But there is a place for it.
Yeah.
But moving forward, man, I know you're a big flintlock guy. You,
mm-hmm.
you love the powder.
Yes.
Can't get enough of the spark.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So tell me, man, how'd you get hooked on flintlock hunting? I mean, you're in the best state for it.
I know, one of probably one of the very few states that actually has a season 4 muzzleloader, you know, flintlock.
And we refuse to budge. Like, this is what we have.
Yeah.
Yes. Before we even get into that, man, I got to hit you real quick on that because I've talked to a couple guys and like they want change with the flintlock season. Do you like it the way it is?
Personally, right now, because I know a couple years ago they had made a change where I think they gave us like an extra week or so. Mm. Of course, it always depended too, like how when Christmas fell to kind of, you know, dictated how like how much, you know, flintlock season that there was going to be.
Right.
But I would say now with the amount of time that we do get, I feel that that's, you know, it's a fair amount of time for muzzleloader season because we're typically now getting anywhere from 2.5 to 3 weeks, maybe a little bit even longer than that. I know this past season, it seemed like flintlock season was on for a good while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I would say now, like, the way that it is now, I feel is good, you know, from what I can see.
Okay. Yeah, I would agree with you. I don't mind where it is right now. I will tell you, I'm not the biggest fan of the in-season muzzleloader that's in the archery season.
Yeah.
But they want to kill more deer.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
I mean, that's how you're going to do it. So, hey, hats off to you if that's what you're into. I just am real big in archery.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm on the game lands too, and I don't mind sharing the game lands with the small game guy and stuff like that, but then, you know, we're putting on deer drives in archery season, and deer are already pressured. So I'm like, dang, you know. But other than that, man, give me some stories, man. You got to tell me what your flintlock hunting's like, what you seen, what you've been into, because everybody who hunts flintlock, they love to hear about it.
Cause oh, yeah.
You pulled the trigger, and you know, you put your hand out in front of you, and you shook it back and forth, and the smoke cleared, and you're like, I know I hit that deer, and no, you hit the tree that was 3 feet from it, right?
Oh, yeah. So, I've been there. Yeah, for sure.
So how'd you get into it first, and then give us some stories?
Yeah, so my pap on my mom's side of the family, he was really big into flintlocks and loved to collect flintlocks, always would shoot them all the time. And I remember I was probably about 16 or 17 is kind of when I got into muzzleloader hunting. Cause I didn't really start it when I first, you know, was able to carry a gun hunting wise, but he was the one that probably really talked me into going. And, he said, it's neat how you can, you know, you put the powder in the barrel and then, you know, the powder in the flash pan and, you know, you either using a round ball and patch or, you know, mm-hmm. maxi ball or anything like
right.
that. And I thought that was pretty cool. So I started shooting a little bit and, you know, he was kind of guiding me, telling me what to do. And then, you know, my uncle too was kind of another one that got me into it. And, I remember the first year that I took one out. I didn't kill a deer the first year, but I remember I missed like 7 or 8 of them. And, I knew, like, okay, I definitely need some practice here, and that's what my pap told me. He's like, biggest thing I could tell you is just practice, practice, practice. Mm-hmm. So that's what I started to do. I started kept shooting, you know, during the summertime and things like that, and, you know, as we get into hunting season and stuff. But, yeah, like I said, I've killed, like I said, after Christmas is always just been one of my seasons where I really like to spend a lot of time in the woods there with muzzleloader, and usually I get together with some friends and we usually do some drives and stuff together, and it's always fun. Like, we're going and, you know, we end up getting the deer moving because you'll hear like either click or like, oh dang it, gun didn't go off this time, or misfired, or oh right. I shot underneath him, and it's just neat just doing it with with a black powder weapon. And not this past hunting season, but the hunting season before, I remember my pap, he said he had killed a lot of deer with muzzleloader, but he never killed a buck. And, like I said, been back in 2022, I killed a buck with muzzleloader, and I was like, that was pretty cool to do.
Right.
And like I said, I was like, this one's for you, pap, because like I said, I knew he always tried to kill buck with one, but he never did. So I just, when I shot that one, I was like, this is for you, pap. Yeah. Like I said, that was pretty cool.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
I've never killed one with a buck. I've only actually even been around or seen like 3 of them killed in the second season with a flintlock.
Yeah.
A couple in archery, but
Yeah, it's really impressive, man. It takes a lot.
It does.
You know, like summer one, you're going to fight the weather, right? It's that time of the year where it starts getting
absolutely
nasty. I can remember some downright cold. Like, you know, them negatives.
Yeah.
And my dad's like, what the hell are you doing? You know, I'm like, I wouldn't kill buck yet. I need to get out there. And he's like, yeah, sure, you're going to freeze to death.
Yeah, that was like this hunting season too. Like I know the day after Christmas this past year, it wasn't the greatest conditions either. Like I said, there was, we had about 5 or 6 guys the day after Christmas, and we did like 1 or 2 drives, and then the rain settled in, and like, we're going to be wasting time here at this point. So then we took a little break for a while, and then gave it a couple hours, and then they're like, well, I know there's a lot of humidity and moisture in the air, just going to have to keep the powder dry the best you can. Yeah. And like I said, I did kill one a day after Christmas. I shot a doe. And like I said, this was probably one of the better seasons I ever had muzzleloader. I killed 3 does of flintlock this past year.
Now, did you shoot them all on drives, or like, is there a certain process that you have, like when you go to set up on deer in second season, do you know where you're going? Are you scouted out? Like, or are you like, no, that spot's pretty good. And like, I know there was some good feed on that red oak or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Like I said, just kind of like look for good, you know, spots that I know, like after Christmas, like late season, where I've seen deer, you know, whether it was in there for a food source, or, you know, in there for a good bedding area, or if it was just a spot where they hadn't been bothered to, because at that point in the season, they hear sticks breaking, they're on high alert at that point, because they've been chased all fall long and everything else. Right. But if you, like I said, if it's, especially with the snow and stuff too, I mean, definitely makes it easier for tracking and picking out stuff too. But probably just keying in like on food sources at that time of the year, you know, because if it's real cold, they're not going to be far from their food source, because right.
They just don't have the energy to burn.
Exactly. But and like I said, I just try to just think of those historical spots and late season where they like to key in on. Yeah.
Plus another thing that's fun is like, not only driving them, because I think that's a blast. As long as you're with the right people and you know what you're doing and you're safe.
Yes.
And
yes.
And you're trying to actually wind check the deer a little bit too.
Yeah.
Because I feel like a lot of guys don't do that. They just set up wrong. And then whenever, so say they put the posters out and the wind's hitting the posters in the back, right?
Yeah.
And the guys go in the woods and they're like, yeah, the drivers did better. Or they, you know, or, well, in that spot, the drivers usually do better. Well, the predominant wind in that area is probably not what you're looking at, right? So those deer, they know they're there, and they want to circle back behind the pushers, and then the pushers are shooting them.
Yeah.
Or the flankers are killing all the deer.
Yeah.
You know, but when you wind check, that's what – it surprises me. I get blown away sometimes that guys don't know this, you know. And I'm like, Kendall, we would just set up opposite of that. Well, you can't really push that properly. I'm like, well – okay, it's fine, but I'm just telling you that's why your posters are shooting a deer there, you know, usually.
Yeah.
But when you set it up right and you can wind check the deer, usually as soon as you step in the woods and start making some noise, you know, you'll hear the guns start going off.
Yeah.
But I really like how they, you know, they herd up, they'll herd back up.
Yeah.
So, like, you don't usually just see one deer.
No, there's usually multiple deer, yeah.
Right. And my brother told me a story about this year. They were all hunting together, and they had six. He said there were 6 shooter bucks. They were all herded together.
No kidding.
And they come down, and everybody's shooting, you know, and everybody had already shot. And they circled. The deer turned back and circled. Everybody's reloading. They weren't reloading, and they ran right in front of everybody again. It was a funny story he told me. I'm like, oh, man, that's pretty wild to get that many shooter bucks together. He said, no. Yeah. He said they were all very nice deer. That's impressive, but – that's like one of the thrills of the flintlock season, you know, that, and you can't be afraid to miss.
Yeah, that, and the one of the biggest things that, like I said, my pap said it multiple times, and even my dad too, and I've said it, you definitely have to have a sense of humor, because, like I said, they don't always go off when you anticipate them to.
Well, that, and then there is kind of the part that nobody talks about with muzzleloader hunting, and not just flintlock, but even slug gun hunting.
Yeah.
Now, slug gun hunting has come a long way with the type of bullets you can use. But for the most part, the deer hit with any of those large calibers like that, like a 50 cal or 45 cal, you know, your Hawkins rifles and such, yeah. they don't bleed very good.
No.
At least in my experience, and I've shot a couple of deer with muzzleloaders and slug guns, and the same thing with family and friends that I've helped track deer.
Yeah.
They usually, with a decent shot, they're not going to go far anyway.
Right.
But sometimes you're in that thick stuff, and you can't find them. Like, you got to mm-hmm. really search for them. So is that, like, some of, have you run into that, too?
Yeah. Yeah, by far, like, far as my set of muzzleloader, like I said, I used a round bomb patch mm-hmm. for a long time. Like I said, and
80 grains.
Yeah, my first muzzleloader flintlock that I used, it was a CVA 45 caliber, mm-hmm. and I would use about 65 grains of 2F powder. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I did kill a deer or two with it, but then I got I have a 50 caliber now. It's a Tradition Hawk and Woodsman, mm-hmm. and I love using the maxi balls. The maxi balls just seem like they really put a good hole in the deer. Mm-hmm. And I've had a lot more success far seeing blood
yeah.
with them.
Is there a set trigger on your gun?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, like I said, once you pull that set trigger, I swear sometimes if you just breathe on that thing, it's going to go off.
Yeah. Well, for those of you that are listening that might not know what we're talking about, so these guns will have two triggers. The back trigger will set, and then the front trigger is the trigger that will go off. And the reason you want that is because the gun is able to surprise you a little bit more than you pulling and flinching.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is the concept behind it. And it works. Yeah. For me, it works.
Yes.
And it's the same concept like you guys at rifle hunt. You know, if your gun is a 4-pound, 5-pound trigger, I'd say 5-pound or more, like you're probably squeezing the trigger.
Yeah.
You know, you need to get that looked at. That's not good.
Yeah.
You should have, you know, in my opinion, I like a 2.5, 3-pound trigger on my guns.
Yeah.
That mm-hmm. seems to be the
yeah.
the nice spot for me. But yeah, man, the flintlock hunting is awesome. Mm-hmm. You know, is making your own something that you've thought about, or
I wouldn't mind taking on that project sometime. Like the muzzleloader that my pap used, it was a custom made muzzleloader, mm-hmm. and it was actually a 62 caliber. Mm-hmm. And that thing, it was a tank.
Yeah. Took everything to lift it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, I would like to do that sometime. I think that would be a neat project to do in the future.
Now, the open sights that are on your gun, do you just have a peep, like open top peep? Do you have a circle peep? What do you have on your sights?
It's just iron sights.
Just straight iron?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep, iron sights. Yeah. And, like I said, something else that I have now, I haven't killed a deer with it yet, but it's definitely one that I'm going to try to, is I actually have a flintlock pistol.
Mm.
And it's a lot of fun to shoot.
Yeah.
And
so you really want to be a pirate is what you're saying.
Well, maybe. You never But I definitely would like to try to shoot one with that thing. I think it'd be pretty cool.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
That would be really cool.
Yeah.
One of my buddies, you know him, actually. He's real into that, too. And I think that's his goal. He really wants to do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we got it really good with the flintlock thing, man. Like that is something that's hard to explain to a lot of people until they go and do it. And
oh yeah.
Like, this is awesome. Like
mm-hmm. it's,
you know, like we're all playing on the same playing field when it comes to that stuff. And
yeah. Yeah. It's just a good time of the year to get together after Christmas and, you know, put some deer drives on and have a good time.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think that, you know, the reason, at least for me, why I like driving deer so much is because it's the camaraderie that comes with it is like unmatched. And it's like kind of if you and your dad push a buck to your pap or something, like it's not like your pap's the only one that shot and
right.
killed that deer. It's yep. like everybody is going to, you know, celebrate that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like we did this together.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that was like the very first buck I ever killed. I killed with a rifle, and like I said, my dad was there beside me when I shot it. And as I had shot it, it was running away. Mm-hmm. My pap actually had seen that deer, and he watched it go down. So it was kind of neat. Like my pap seen right. the tail end of it. My
the
dad
third
was
generation,
there.
Right?
Yeah. So we were all three there. You know, after we got up to the deer, so it was
that
pretty cool.
A special moment.
Yeah,
that is a really special. I can remember. It's one of them things. You know, I shot my first deer, and I actually used a 410 pumpkin ball is what I had.
whatever you want to call it, slug gun.
Yeah.
Smooth bore. So single shot, doe come down, bang, I shot her. I was with my dad. My uncle pushed her to me. And he's like, okay, boy, well, you know, you got to gut her out. I'm like, okay, you know, I don't know what the hell I'm doing, you know. And I get in there. You got hair everywhere. You don't really know what you're doing. I remember he pulled the heart out. He's like, well, now you got to take a bite of the heart. And I'm like, what? It's like a real thing, you know. But I've heard that. I've also heard people, you know, like they'll take some blood, put it on their face or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's all. It's all part of the kill, man, and it's all like a celebratory thing, you know. One thing that I've learned to do whenever I, you know, kill an animal or whatnot is just have that moment with it and, you know, thank it and all that stuff. And it's – I always talk about that because hunters, no matter what, sometimes get a bad name, right?
Yeah.
Like you guys are just out to kill. I'm like, that's not – no. That's not what we do. Now, I will tell you, like, some guys will say, well, I harvested this. Like, I don't know how I feel about that. Like, I – no, you killed it. Mm-hmm. You killed it. You ended its life, you know. And, yeah, you're going to, you know, clean everything up, process it, feed your family, feed yourself, whatever, the whole cycle, right? And that's the way it should be. But, like, to me, if you harvest it, like, did you grow this thing from, like, you know, the ground? And, like,
yeah.
You know, like, I don't know. I just, to me, I don't really like the term. I feel like it's, like, a more political correct thing than saying, mm-hmm. you just killed it, but.
Yeah.
I don't know. Sometimes it doesn't sit well with me. I just like to say, yeah, you know, that's the deer I killed this year. And, or that, you know, I shot that deer and killed that deer this year also.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, moving on to some of the thoughts that you think here in Pennsylvania, we did talk about the DCNR, the Fish Commission, you know, some of the stuff that they're doing with waterways and everything. But on the flip side of that, is there anything else like that you think here in Pennsylvania, like that we are doing well, whether that be hunting, fishing, hiking, you know, whatever that is, and then compared to some other stuff that you think that maybe we could do better at?
Yeah, I would say, like I said, I'm gonna kind of probably go for like towards like the Game Commission on this one here.
Okay, as you probably should. You know, there's some things. Hey, that's why we do what we do, right? We all are allowed to have our opinions.
Yeah.
And some of their stuff is politically motivated. I mean, it's a that's a fact,
mm-hmm.
right? It's the guys that are in place there, they don't even want to do what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Or they don't think what they're doing is not right. It's just there's nothing.
Yeah.
It's not politically driven. So if there's no money behind it, unfortunately, mm-hmm. it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
Or if this senator and that senator or whoever is in power – mm-hmm. is like, hey, you need to take that away. And they're like, we're not doing that. And he's like, well, your funding's gone. They're going to do it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's let bygones be bygones, you know. And that's fact. That's not like hidden information. So
mm-hmm.
we're all entitled to our opinion, and I'd love to hear yours.
Yeah. Kind of going like with the whole muzzleloader season, like I said, now there's still, like I said, before, you know, the upcoming seasons and to all those dates and stuff would be posted and any changes like that. But I have seen some possible talk in certain areas where they've talked about maybe bringing in a late rifle season after Christmas, which would definitely cut down on the amount of time where it would just be flintlock hunting and archery hunting only.
Mm.
And I just guess, just as for me, in a sense, I've always enjoyed that time where it's just, you know, archery and flintlock season, and you know, nobody else is really in the woods that time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And
the primitive people are.
Yeah. And I mean, I understand, like, I mean, for the amount of doe licenses that they're trying to sell, they're definitely, they want the deer shot. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no other way around it.
Right.
And I just think for that time of the year, I don't know, just, I don't think there should be a rifle season that time of the year. I think where it would just, like I said, that's nothing set in stone. It was just something that I'd seen from a meeting that they had here not too long ago. But like I said, I'm sure there's probably some other people out there that enjoy that time of the year where it's just flintlock hunting and, you know, bow hunting only.
Most definitely.
Yeah, that and, you know, I did see possibly where they're, which I kind of feel like it was coming in the future, was the early muzzleloader season for bear. I seen where they're talking about cutting that back to 3 days now instead of a full week.
Makes sense. Just from what the numbers look like.
Yeah, which yeah, wouldn't be, you know, a bad idea, I don't think, on the bear part. Yeah, I think definitely. Which this past year was the first time I ever went bear hunting, so that was a whole nother experience for me too.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, bear hunting in our state, it's getting better and better. But like you said, I did see the numbers were down for the kill rates, which could be a lot of things.
Yeah.
Doesn't necessarily mean that's why, but I've heard people say that that's one thing they want to look at.
Yeah, that and probably something else too. Like I said, I didn't really mention too much, but I do have a bird dog. I have a Brittany Spaniel that I use for pheasant hunting. Mm. And now this year, he'll be 9 years old this year. But I remember the first couple of years, like, they were stalking lots of ringnecks. And it was great to get him in constant contact with ringnecks. And he really has turned out well to be a really good dog. And then it was probably after about 3 or 4 years of having him, they started this whole pheasant stamp deal, which, and then it seemed like they also cut back on the amount of pheasants they were stocking. And I'm thinking in my head, like, if we're all paying for a pheasant stamp at this point, I feel like they should almost be putting, like, more pheasants out, in a sense. I mean, that's just my opinion, because if you're buying that stamp and it's going towards something, because I know they had, there was a hatchery or something happened where they had shut down and they started cutting back on the amount of birds that they were stalking.
So what I know of that is that the Game Commission was paying way too much for their birds.
Yeah.
Is what was going on.
Yeah.
From, you know, certain places and stuff where me and you might have been paying anywhere from $14 to $16 a ringneck. They were paying upwards of like 30.
Yeah.
And basically to me, what that sounds like is I'm the farmer. I raise them. You're the guy that buys them, and me and you are buddies, and I'm going to make mine.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I mean, that's the way business works.
Right.
But I'm sure that that had something to do with
pheasant stamp.
The pheasant stamp, you know, prices on everything going up. Just right now, man, like, look at milk. Jeez.
I know.
You know what I mean? Anything. And it doesn't matter. Gasoline for you to drive here was cost you freaking $8 to drive to Asheville.
Probably, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's pretty wild, wild times, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, they have the stamp. I haven't looked at the numbers to see exactly how much money goes where and where it's allotted.
Yeah.
I will tell you that I know of places that see ample ringnecks stocked. Maybe it's just because I know the right people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they're like, hey, I know they're putting them here, and they probably do put them there because the group of people that are there, right?
Yeah.
They know the people that stalk them, and they're like, hey, we want them here.
Mm.
And they put them there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, yeah, it's just one of them things. It's who you know for that. But, yeah, I will just throw in my two cents on things to see change maybe is I know that the season for the fisher is really, really short for trapping.
Yeah, I agree with that one there.
And I'm like blown away how many people are like showing me pictures of a lot of fishers they're getting. I'm like, what the hell? Like, where are they coming from? Like, I know they're here, and I can remember them not being here at all. And now, like, I have people showing me, I'm like, what the hell? You have like 6 or 7 fishers on camera, different ones. Like, how?
Yeah.
I didn't even know that they could, like, live like that amongst each other. I thought they were, like, super, like, territorial of their. But, like, and I want one. So I really wish that they would make the season a little bit longer.
Yeah, I agree there, too. Yeah, because I've been wanting to catch one in a trap. Yeah,
that's right. I want to mount one. That's my biggest.
That and a bobcat. I've never caught a bobcat, and that's something else that I'd like to catch,
Never caught one, but there's a dead one in there. So
yeah.
But they could probably look to make that season longer. The bobcat, that, man, I can't believe there's that many bobcats around, honest to God. I see more and more people showing me all these pictures, and I talk to some people that hunt them with dogs, and which is awesome.
I
think that is just, like, badass. I love it. I love that. I think it's so cool.
Yeah.
But they're on them, man. There's a lot of them around, so. I know, and I'm going to give Josh a shout out again, but, like, if you guys have private ground and you want the coyotes killed, you need to let the guys with the dogs in to kill them. I'm just going to say it again. because there's a lot. Yeah. I seen the biggest coyote I've ever seen in my life. I was driving from Crescent up to Munster. I don't care who knows this, because maybe somebody's on this dog. I know there's a coyote hunt this weekend. And I don't care who knows it, but it's the biggest dog I've ever seen. And it was standing in the field. I thought it was a house dog. I had to stop the truck, turn around. Mm-hmm. I'm like, no way. I mean, it's a monster. Had to have been over 50 pounds easily.
Yeah.
So these dogs are getting bigger, man. It's wild.
I know. Yeah, because there a few weekends ago for Mosquito Creek, there was 53-pounder killed first place.
That's wild.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I'm telling you, man, this dog I seen, I mean, he is big. It mm-hmm. had to been a big male.
But, yeah.
But that's pretty much what I got for you, man. I really appreciate you coming out here. This,
yeah.
I hope you enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
Seems like you did.
Yeah.
This show brings nothing but joy to a lot of people. I always have people hit me up, and they're like, man, I just love listening to you guys just BS about stuff and bringing stuff up. And, you know, before we go, man, where can anybody that wants to reach out to you or maybe ask you some questions about fly fishing, maybe ask you some questions about flintlock, where can they reach you at?
Like I said, they can find me probably like on Instagram or something like that. My Instagram is jchilcote_1123.
Okay.
Like I said, I do post a lot of stuff like on stories and things mm-hmm. on there. And if anybody would want to see like, you know, any fly tying patterns or anything like that, or, you know, some tips and pointers on flintlock hunting or, mm-hmm. you know, anything as far as that, you know, feel free to send a message that way.
Good deal, man. Well, we appreciate you coming on the show. Anybody wants to reach out to Jewel, he's happy to field anything you got for him. And, guys, we appreciate all the support. And thanks for coming back and listening to another episode of The Chronicles. Guys, have a good week, and we'll get back to you with some more guests.
Ladies and gentlemen, my faithful listeners, you have reached the end of another episode of the Keystone Chronicles podcast. Guys, I love talking on the end of these and saying thank you so much for tuning in and thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate everybody. I love doing this for you guys. Reach out to me. Let me know what you want to hear, and I'll keep bringing you as much content as I can. Thank you, guys. Get out there. Find some damn deer sheds. Find some damn turkeys, and enjoy this coming spring.